Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief. We hope you've finalized those travel plans by now for Thanksgiving. I'm Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance, broadcasting this week from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. Today, with talk about religion practically a prerequisite for candidates who want to be president, we'll talk to the psychiatrist who's been putting Bush on the couch to find out what it really means when politicians talk about God. Plus, who's responsible for turning Mormonism into the latest campaign boogeyman? We'll find out when we distribute some intersection awards. And in our Faith on Film segment,
I've had my life threatened. I've had people try to beat me up. I had a woman who was about 60 years old cuss me out and spit on me for not having a PS3 for her 6-year-old grandson.
As we approach the busiest shopping day of the year, one movie is asking, what would Jesus buy? But first, some new developments in an old debate over the appropriateness of putting the word God in public places. It was last week when the largest high school district in the country voted to allow displays bearing the nation's motto, In God We Trust, in classrooms and offices. The mandate had been proposed by one of the district trustees in Bakersfield, California, as a way of promoting patriotism. But the idea quickly ignited a heated dispute. The school board president said he would vote against the displays because they reflected a spiritual agenda, which he said belongs at home and at church, not in the educational system. But those who supported the displays said that the displays are an important step in putting patriotism on the agenda in schools. Patriotism, that one Bakersfield councilwoman defined as, quote, love of God and country. She added, we are faith-based people for the most part. Sometimes you have to go with the majority. It was a 4-1 majority, in fact, that approved the display last week. The similarity between that case and one that went all the way to the Supreme Court over the constitutionality of the words under God in the Pledge of Allegiance was not lost on us. And so, apparently, it wasn't lost on the man who first brought that case to court. In the same week that the Bakersfield District made its decision, it was announced that attorney Michael Newdow is representing an anonymous New Hampshire couple who feel it inappropriate to recite the pledge with the words under God in public schools. So, how does Michael Newdow think the case will fare 3 years after the Supreme Court rejected it on procedural grounds? Does he think the current climate of religion in the public square will make his case easier or harder this time? Michael Newdow joins us now on the phone from his home in Sacramento, California. Michael, welcome to State of Belief.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
What made you jump back into this fight on behalf of this New Hampshire couple?
Well, the case is actually proceeding right now in California, and I'm hopeful that if we prevail in California, this will make any other case moot. But in the event that I lose in California, I want to be able to come. I have plaintiffs actually in every circuit in the country, and I plan on going through all of them until we get this to the Supreme Court.
Clarify for us, does the Pledge Protection Act that was passed in 2006 effectively prevent this from ever getting back to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, it's actually a very interesting act. It didn't pass the Senate. It only passed the House, so it isn't law. But were it law, it would, if it were upheld, preclude anyone from going to the federal courts to make a challenge. But probably would affect state courts, too, through preemption. But I don't think it'll ever get passed. I think it would be an unconstitutional law. I mean, where would you end? That act said that Congress can tell the courts what kind of issues can be heard, which it can to some degree, but not certainly in terms of things like religious freedom, et cetera.
Michael, you've seen recent polling data, just like I have, some indicating that 2/3 of this country are under the belief that the United States is a Christian nation. Do you ever wonder if your efforts have any chance of succeeding?
Well, even if they believe that, there's nothing about Christianity that I'm aware of that says they shouldn't follow the golden rule. I think we just have to educate people and have them understand that they're correct, that the framers of our nation were Christian. They also were white. They also were men. That has nothing to do with what the Constitution protects, and that document that they created protects everybody. And so even if you think of it in terms of a Christian nation being, yes, we had founders who were Christian, so what? They were wonderful Christians who created a magnificent document that protects everybody of every religion.
I know that you identify yourself not as an atheist activist at all, but as an equal rights activist. But I'm wondering, what's your take on how, if at all, the national attitude toward atheists, toward non-church-related people has changed since you first brought this case to the national stage?
It's tough to know. I'm sure I'm biased by what I see, but I'm very impressed by how many people, plenty of Christians and strong God believers, who are on my side. When this case went to the Supreme Court, you know, there were 32 named Christian and Jewish clergy who wrote a brief supporting me. This is not a case of people who believe in God versus people who don't believe in God. Mm-hmm. It's a case of people who believe in equality versus people who don't believe in equality. And once people understand that, I give talks all the time to, you know, religious groups. And every time I get people coming up after and say, we didn't understand what the case was about. We think you're right, and we'll support you.
If we could, I'd probably just ask you to say what you just said another time and just shout it instead of saying it, because it is a correction to a misunderstanding that we run into all time. Michael, what keeps you going? I mean, you're bound to get discouraged sometimes. You're bound to get tired. What keeps you going on this?
Well, I mean, I haven't lost yet. So I'm hoping I'm going to win. I know I'm right. I know that our nation is based on equality, and that that's what this case is about. It's a civil rights case, just like any other. And I think this Constitution is an amazing document. I think these guys were really brilliant, and we should all respect what they did for us, and we should uphold it. And I'm trying to do that, and I think our nation will be stronger when we reach true equality, which we don't have right now in terms of religion.
We got a press release this week from an author named Jim Percy, whom I don't know, who had this to say about efforts to remove references to God. These are his words. It's said that 86% of Americans believe in God. We just need to tell that other 14% to sit down and be quiet. What would you say to that guy as to why you're not being quiet?
Oh, because 100% of Americans believe in equality. And when they realize that what he's advocating is inequality, then they won't be on his side. Right? They see this right now. That's why the emphasis needs to be made. This is not against God. It's against inequity. And, you know, those polls aren't asking the right question. Do you want your government to reflect your view, and you get 90% of the population saying yes? Of course you do. That's why we have an establishment clause. The framers knew that people would answer that poll that way. But the right question to ask is, do you want the government, our government, to respect all religious views equally? And I think just about everybody would say yes. And if they understand that that's what this case is, we won't have any problem.
Michael, you articulate the meaning of the First Amendment in a wonderfully powerful way. And we are glad to have you on the program and hope that the understanding that you've shared with us will spread. Michael Newdow is an attorney and a physician. He is a tremendous advocate for separation of church and state in public institutions. He believes both in the Free Exercise Clause and the No Establishment Clause of the Constitution and wants all of us to do the same. Michael, thanks for being with us on State of Belief.
Thank you very much for having me.
As a minister, I get a lot of questions about my views on the use of the name of God in public venues. As a matter of fact, on the day of the Bakersfield School Board decision, I was being interviewed on a very conservative radio talk show in that area of the country. When the host asked me if I had a problem with the school board posting the words, "In God We Trust," I told him that I did have a problem with it. I mentioned the constitutional issues involved, and then I said, but as a person who values religion, I resent people attempting to turn the holy God into a kind of religious Uncle Sam for the American people without thought of what such action does to desacralize a name that some people consider too holy even to speak. And to my surprise, the host spontaneously responded, "Amen." Look, this matter of how we use God's name in public schools and government agencies is not an issue of patriotism. It is an issue of religious freedom. The institutions of our government should be supported and all citizens of our nation should be respected apart from an imposed demand for a theistic confession. Still to come, a Muslim map of Los Angeles and a rebuke of Mitt Romney in a major American magazine are the subjects of our Intersection Awards. Who's getting the green light and who's being stopped in the red? You'll find out next. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief on Air America Radio. Welcome back to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. We were just talking with Michael Newdow about his court cases challenging the constitutionality of the phrase under God. And in many ways, we understand Michael's fight. It's not easy to operate the traffic lights at the intersection of religion and politics. In fact, it can only be done through the efforts of many hands and many voices. Well, thankfully, here at the Interfaith Alliance, we have a staff committed to policing that intersection, none more thoroughly than our press secretary, William Blake. William is usually our primary conduit to news about religion and politics. In fact, before many of us are even awake in the morning, he's already scoured hundreds of stories from the day's news, and he lets us know what we should be keeping our eyes on. William is here with me in the studio right now, and I'm going to let him handle the nominations for this week's Intersection Awards, our very own traffic lights at the intersection of religion and politics.
Well, thanks for having me back on the show, Welton. I have two stories for you today that will encompass actually three intersectional awards. And I guess we should start off with some good news. A green light, I think, should go to the Los Angeles Police Department for abruptly scrapping a program to map the city's Muslim population. Just last week, the department said that this scheme was needed to identify potential hotbeds of extremism. But after a week of protests from Muslim groups, the LAPD changed its tune. Police officials announced they would drop the mapping program but continue their efforts to reach out to the Muslim community, an announcement met with approval from Muslim activist groups. And now, Welton, the issue of racial profiling has been around for years, and I wonder, does this story demonstrate that religious profiling is now just as big a problem in our country?
You know, actually, William, I don't think the story is about religious profiling. I think it is about political profiling. And it's being done under the guise of a concern for national security. I'm really pleased that the Los Angeles Police Department's walked away from that because, you know, I was wondering, for example, if they were going to put bright lights and bright lines around 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, because there are many ways in which to threaten security in this nation, and it's not all from the outside. You have an administration that is ignoring the Constitution. I would single them out for danger as well, and there are many different kinds of security. We've got to get back in this nation to understanding security in relation to the integrity of democracy as envisioned in the Constitution. Good for the Los Angeles Police Department, and I hope that what they have recognized as a fault will be recognized as a fault by a lot of other people in this nation.
Well, you know, with the Iowa caucuses just a couple of months away, we have to return to the campaign trail for our second story up for the Intersection Awards, where we find the media is once again just a little too fascinated with Governor Mitt Romney's Mormon faith. A journalist for the New Republic wrote a story this week that begins as follows. Mitt Romney has earned a well-earned reputation as a flip-flopper, but it's one thing to flip-flop on your politics and quite another to flip-flop on your faith. The story then outlines some instances where Romney has attempted to obfuscate certain details about Mormon beliefs in order, the journalist claims, to appeal to evangelical Christian voters. So I suppose perhaps a yellow light should be awarded to Governor Romney because certainly he needs to proceed with caution when talking about his faith given the media's obsession with this topic. But Welton, would you agree with me that the New Republic deserves a red light? You know, even if Romney is giving incomplete answers about his faith, isn't there no excuse for the media asking the wrong types of questions?
I would agree with that. I think the media is forcing an emphasis on religion on the campaign trail that might not be there otherwise. But, you know, I don't happen to agree that what has been going on with Romney is about flip-flopping on his religion. What I think is going on is he's being less than candid about his religion. He wants to claim to be a good Mormon and he wants to be a good Christian, but then when he's pressed on the details of specific beliefs within that tradition, he backs away from it. That's not flip-flopping. That's a lack of candor. And let me add one other thing to that. I know that ever since the last presidential campaign, this thing of flip-flopping has become a bad idea and a tag that you throw at people that you want defeated. I personally want leaders in this nation who can change their minds. My gosh, we ought to know by now that the most dangerous people are those who say, I will never change my mind. We know what that's like. And sometimes, whether it's in politics or in religion, it's not flip-flopping to make an honest decision in which you say, I was once wrong, I've changed my mind, I'm going a different direction. Well, William, thank you for being on the program again today. It's always a joy to have you and your voice here. We'll do something again soon.
Thanks, Welton.
Still to come, we'll find out what would Jesus buy in our Faith on Film segment. And coming up next, the doctor who has psychoanalyzed President Bush tells us why politicians feel compelled to talk about religion. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio.
State of Belief, once a week, not enough? Check out our website, stateofbelief.com.
In constant sorrow through his day.
Freedom is ingrained in people's souls. Freedom was not placed there by the United States. It was, my judgment, it was placed there by something greater, the Almighty. But I want you to understand, I want your listeners to understand, I don't get to decide who goes to heaven. The Almighty God decides who goes to heaven.
Welcome back to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. Over the past 7 years of his two terms in office, much has been made about President Bush's personal faith and the way it relates to his politics. He has often told audiences, both in private and in public, that God called him to serve as president and that it was God's will for the U.S. to, quote, end the tyranny in Iraq. Dr. Justin Frank gained a great deal of attention with his 2004 book, Bush on the Couch, in which he psychoanalyzed the president as he would one of his patients at his practice in Washington, D.C. An extended version of the book has just been released in paperback, and we thought it would be a good time for Dr. Frank to return to the therapist chair as we put the relationship between religion and politics on the very same couch. Dr. Justin Frank is a clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry at George Washington University Medical Center. And Dr. Frank joins us now in the studio. Dr. Frank, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you. It's very good to be here.
I want to ask you about writing the book, but I think even before that, what even gave you the idea of writing this book?
Well, it was actually given to me by me. I got the idea because I was noticing that President Bush, even before he became president, when he was president-elect, exhibited some characteristics and some traits on television that were very similar to some of my patients, especially patients who had been alcoholics and patients who had had alcoholic parents. So even when he came back from the Hanging Chad incident in Florida in November, mid-November of 2000, I was struck by how he looked really like he'd been on a bender or something, which I didn't believe, but I was struck by it. Mm-hmm. And several of my patients said that he reminded them of their father after he would come home and they wouldn't know whether he'd been drinking or not.
So you get into the project and you begin to look at this guy, and you don't go long, obviously, without discovering his talk about religion and his references to religion. What was it that first stood out to you about his use of religion?
Well, the first thing that stood out to me was that he said over and over again that he had had a real religious conversion kind of experience in 1986, that he stopped drinking in 1986 at the age of 40, and that he essentially stopped with the help of Reverend Billy Graham and with a couple of other religious people who visited him in Texas, in Midland, Texas. And since then, he owed a lot of his ability to stay out of alcohol with his newfound faith. He told his parents within a few months that he felt like he had had a born-again experience. So I think that's the first thing, and I knew that about him fairly early on when I was reading about him.
Now, did red flags go up?
No, not then.
Not then?
Except that the only red flag is that I'm very much in favor of the people using Alcoholics Anonymous. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he insisted that he never went to an AA meeting and never had to do that made me wonder if religion was a substitute for AA for him.
You know, and I know, that back in 2000, he was visiting with a Texas preacher, and he said that God wanted him to run for president. In your opinion, do statements like that come from deep within the president, or is he pandering?
In my opinion, I think that he believes what he says. So in that sense, they come from deep within the president. I think that over time, he became more pandering. But I think that that statement is really a basic statement. It serves deeper functions psychologically. I don't know if you want to get into that now, but basically that kind of statement makes it very hard for other people to question him. So on the one hand, it comes from a deep belief, and it may not be pandering, but it also is an extremely self-protective statement, because if God spoke to him, or God, he believes that God wanted him to run, it's pretty hard to argue against that. So one of the things that I noticed about him early on was his use of his relationship to God as a way of conferring certainty to him about his actions and about what he was doing. It helped him feel more powerful and more committed, and that he used his religion in that way.
So if he is genuine about his expressions of faith, is the idea of Bush as an evangelical president real, or did his handlers create an evangelical president?
I think the idea of Bush as an evangelical president is real. I think his handlers augmented it. We've had one evangelical president before Bush, and that was Jimmy Carter.
Mm-hmm.
From what I don't know a lot about evangelicals from the inside, but what I have a sense is that it's very important to spread the word and to let people know about what Christianity is about through either your deeds or through trying to spread the word. I think that the evangelical presidency quality in Bush, I think, enabled him to make an easy shift from the idea of spreading the word to the idea of spreading freedom in the Middle East. In other words, it's the same kind of mentality, which is an evangelical mentality, that we know what's right, and we're going to spread our ideas and our certainty of what's right, and hopefully other people will appreciate it, and if not, the worry I have is that we'll try to impose that on them.
I understood in part of the book you to say that President Bush was motivated a good bit by fear in moving toward religion and embracing religion. Does that play into his propensity to use fear to advance his policies and to strengthen his presidency?
That's a brilliant question, because it's a very important question, is that if somebody's motivated by something, do they end up using that very thing to promote their own election and their own policies? And also, I think that if you're motivated by fear, you might begin to have insight, and I think he does, even though he won't admit it, into other people and assume that other people are also motivated by fear. And in fact, he's going to try to make other people motivated by fear so he doesn't have to be afraid. The purpose of religion for him, I think, was to manage his own fear. And it's really a fear of being afraid and a fear of fear. And so he puts that into other people and gets other people to be the frightened one. And he's very good at doing that.
Let me remind our listeners, we're talking with Dr. Justin Frank, author of the book Bush on the Couch. Right now, the campaign trail, it sometimes sounds like a revival rather than a political campaign. Where is all that coming from? Are they parroting what they heard that worked for Bush, or where is it coming from?
I think they are parroting it. I just, all of a sudden, all kinds of people start talking about religion and they found religion. And I think that what has been so powerful to these candidates, a lesson, is that a lot of the large religious groups and the big tents where people meet on Sundays in the South in particular, were under the radar of the pollsters. And a lot of people didn't realize how well George Bush was going to do because so many people got out the vote from their religious groups. And I think that right now people are pandering to religion a lot more than I find comfortable and palatable. And I think that Bush did end up pandering to his group. I think that ultimately there's a way in which he is, even if God told him to run for president, there's a way in which he is somewhat cynical towards the believers. And what concerns me is he takes advantage of good Christian people who have lots of faith and who are compassionate and care about people, and uses that faith as a way of stirring up fear about people who are different from them, fear about gays, fear about abortion, fear about all kinds of things, and certainly fear about terrorists. And in doing that, I think he's taking advantage of people's goodwill and faith. Then he gives them the occasional reward through various funding measures or faith-based initiative measures. But basically, I think he does take advantage of people. And I think other people, other candidates see that that works.
Now, there's not a couch in this studio, so I'm not going to lie down, but I do want some counsel. And I want it for myself and for our listeners. Since so much is being talked about religion on the campaign trail, what should we listen for in all of this religious rhetoric, and what should we beware of?
I think the main thing to listen for is the consistency between their words and their records and their deeds. I mean, a person who is a certain kind of baseball player, let's say is a pull hitter, he always is going to hit. They can overshift to the infield, but he's always going to hit. If he's a lefty, he's always going to hit to right field. The people who use religious terms really will have a record, and you can look at their record and look at patterns and look at how they are and see how well it coincides with their religious beliefs. For example, if people really paid attention to Bush, they would have seen that his words about being a Christian didn't really jive with his history of torturing small animals, his pleasure in branding pledges in the fraternity house at Yale. Now, it's true he was converted or born again at the age of 40. So then you could say, well, what about his smirk around the execution of prisoners in Texas when he was governor? This is not a very religious person in that sense. And there was a famous prisoner for murder named Carla Faye Tucker who pleaded for mercy from him because she had been converted and born again in the same way that he had, and he showed no mercy.
Right.
And this is an example not of a Christian person, in my view. And I think that what the voter needs to pay attention to is the relationship between words and deeds and what people do. But I just wouldn't believe everything I hear at this point.
A new updated version of Dr. Frank's book, Bush on the Couch, is available now in paperback. From this interview, you can tell what interesting reading that will be. Dr. Justin Frank, thanks so much for joining us on State of Belief.
Thank you very much for having me.
Coming up, if you're going to make a movie about Reverend Billy and the Church of Stop Shopping, would you name it anything other than What Would Jesus Buy? Faith on Film is next. I'm Welton Getty. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio.
Get ready, the fear is departing.
Now, State of Belief journeys behind the camera lens to get a look at faith on film.
You may remember a few weeks back when we talked with Reverend Billy, the performance artist who was arrested on a New York street corner for reciting this.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble, and to petition the government for redress of grievances. Congress shall make no law.
I said at the time that I would not soon forget the way Reverend Billy delivered those words found in our First Amendment. I haven't forgotten. And I guess that he had the same impact on the filmmakers behind a new documentary called What Would Jesus Buy? The film follows Reverend Billy and his Church of Stop Shopping Gospel Choir on a cross-country trip to save Christmas. Joining us now to talk about the film is Rob Von Alkamati, the director of What Would Jesus Buy? Rob, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you so much.
Now, what is the story that you're trying to tell by following Reverend Billy and the Stop Shopping Choir?
Well, it's an incredible outfit and a tremendous mission, and that First Amendment is one of many miracles that they perform on a regular basis to encourage people to step inward, take a look inside, consider reprioritizing a little bit, taking a step back from the shelf, the product on the shelf, and thinking, what is the most valuable thing in my life this Christmas time and year-round? Is it the gizmo that my kid is wanting for the most because they've seen thousands of advertising events, or is it my time with my child, and so on?
Well, Rob, I am thrilled to death and surprised as well, because I was expecting to talk with you, and I understand that the whole gang is here.
Absolutely.
And, so on the phone with us once again is Reverend Billy, and he's joined by Salvatore D., director of the Church of Stop Shopping.
Hello.
Change-a-luya, Reverend Gatti.
Last time you and I talked, you were in a hotel room in Seattle, I think. This must be the busiest time of the year for your ministry. Is that true?
Yes, especially this year with What Would Jesus Buy? Coming up to Buy Nothing Day on the 23rd, we'll be at the front door of the Lake of Hellfire, that is to say the front door of Macy's department store at 6 a.m. when the sinners are assembled and want to, you know, get in there and get that very special deal on the PlayStation 17 or whatever it is they're buying.
Salvatore, as the director of the Church of Stop Shopping, what in the world is it like to bring your entire choir in full outfit into one of these shopping centers?
Well, these privatized spaces, these retail spaces, are very controlled. We take it for granted. We don't realize how controlled they are because it's also normalized. But if you go into a mall or a store and you just raise your voice a little bit, it becomes very charged very quickly. And I must say, as a theater person and someone who came up on the stage, it's quite a thrill. As well, I think it's a great opportunity. People are in the act of shopping. What better time to ask them to please stop?
Amen.
Is there anything for people who exchange presents at Christmas time? Is there anything they should consider buying?
I would say to examine where the product comes from and try to put your money back into your local economy, either by buying something that was made nearby or by shopping in a small shop, in a mom-and-pop store, an independent store. Keep the money inside your local and regional economies as much as you can, and that's a great start.
Reverend Billy, what would you look at to buy, if anything, as a Christmas present?
Salvatore and I were discussing going out to just taking the A train from Brooklyn out to Coney Island and walking along the edge of the water, or is it going to be frozen?
No, that's global warming, Reverend. It'll be warm.
It's still warm in New York on November 15th. I'm dismayed to report. Well, you know, we might buy something along the way out on Brighton Beach or something, but I think we're thinking more of having an experience of just being together and relaxing.
Let me have each one of you answer one question. What do you hope people take away from this film?
I honestly believe that we have to reclaim our citizenship now and not be consumers to the degree we have been up until now. Because the government is not going to save us from this. We have to make the change. And I see increasing numbers of people who are ready to change?
I think that people are ready to pull back from the product, as Rob said, pull back from the product on the shelf and listen to and be entertained by the colorful, complex visions and dreams and memories that come up to them from their own, the depths of their own soul. We have, with consumerism, a basic con job, which is that you're not good enough yourself. You have to go over there and buy it from the corporation. People are discovering, I think, that they have a media empire right inside their own body. There's a lot to listen to, a lot to be entertained by inside ourselves. Amen.
I'm just hoping people will realize some basic emergencies that are underway here. 60% of us in America are in long-term debt on our credit cards, but we're still going to spend, at least last year, we spent around $100 billion on Christmas gifts on our credit cards. So, you know, we got to slow down a little bit and find out that that's actually even more enjoyable than speeding up.
Rob Van Alkamada's documentary, What Would Jesus Buy?, opens this weekend in select theaters. Check out wwjbmovie.com for locations. Rob, Savitri D., and Reverend Billy, thank all three of you for being with us on State of Belief.
Thank you, Brother Welton. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Amen.
Well, that's our show for this week. If you want to respond to anything you heard today, go to the Contact Us page at stateofbelief.com and send us an email. Or call us at 212-871-8280. That's 212-871-8280. And if you've missed any part of the show or you want to hear past shows, you can download them at stateofbelief.com. Head over to the site and sign up to make our free show archives available to you. All you need is an email address. So what are you waiting for? Go on and listen to some older shows. Next week, as you enjoy Thanksgiving weekend, we hope you'll enjoy listening to some of the best moments from State of Belief in 2007. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, and that's State of Belief.
Billy Ray was the preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along.
State of Belief, religion and radio done differently.